Committee will come to order. It's Tuesday, March 10th, 2009. And I thought we had a more ambitious agenda. Maybe it isn't as ambitious as I thought, but we had planned to spill over into this evening. And what I want to say is that number four on the agenda, the Homestead Lender Mediation Act, it's my understanding that those people understand that we're not going to do the bill until this evening. And I'm sorry, this was decided before I had any clue about the weather. We'll just see how it goes. And we'll get going now and start with Senator Wieger and welcome him to our committee. And we'll just play this by ear. But Senators Lynch and Phoebe, you would definitely be next. And again, Senator Wieger, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate File 404 is a proposal that would require a notice to an applicant for homeowner's insurance. Currently, if you apply for that insurance, you don't necessarily know that there is a right to cancel within the first 60 days. This proposal, straight and simple, gives you that notice, a heads up that there is a right to cancel within the first 60 days. It's initiated by constituent John Wall, who will provide testimony shortly. I want to point out, this is already the law for auto insurance, a right to notice to cancel. And this would have the same public policy. If it's good for autos, why not for homeowners as well? So, Madam Chair, I do have an amendment when appropriate. It would change the effective date to January 1, 2010.
The A1 amendment?
Yes.
It was passed out.
Oh, it's already passed out. And Senator Metzen.
I'll move the amendment.
Senator Metzen moves the A1 amendment. An author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment's adopted. And Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and may I introduce John Wall, North St. Paul.
Welcome, Mr. Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is John Wall. I reside in North St. Paul. We were recently contacted by Liberty Mutual Insurance to essentially get a better rate on our insurance because my wife is an alumna of a particular college. Mm-hmm. We pursued that and primarily talked to the agent over the phone, got information that basically we could get our same type of policy, same or better rate, essentially. And the vast majority of the conversation was conducted over the phone with the agent. We were not provided any information at that time about possible cancellation of the policy. After we received the policy, we received a letter. It doesn't really matter exactly what date, but the policy was effective 5/1. The letter was dated June 30th, 2008. And it said, "Dear valued customer, as a service to our customers, we occasionally inspect the homes we insure to verify adequate coverage and identify any conditions which might increase the potential for future loss." Essentially, what they said is they were writing to advise of a recent inspection, saying that the roof had lifting shingles on the rear and that we had to have that taken care of or our policy would be canceled. Well, this was quite a surprise to us. We were essentially just shopping for another rate. We didn't think that we would run into any type of problem like this. Obviously, if you're trying to reduce your insurance, you're not necessarily thinking you're going to have to reshingle your roof. So we went and got our own inspector, who was a friend of the family, and we got a counter inspection. And he essentially said he'd been in the roofing trade for over 30 years. Liberty Mutual did, in fact, demand a written report from our inspector. We sent that. It cost us $50. If the person hadn't been a friend of the family, it probably would have cost us considerably more. And we also were concerned because we thought that we could very well have our policy canceled. And then we would either have to go back to our previous insurance company. We didn't know what the effect would be because we'd already, in this case, would have had our policy canceled. So we thought perhaps we would be subject to an inspection and possibly quite an expensive roof repair. It turned out that our other inspector found that there was essentially a lifting leaf gutter in the back and that their inspector was wrong. Liberty Mutual agreed, and we are still with Liberty Mutual. We contacted the Minnesota State Insurance Commissioner, who said that this happens fairly often and we should contact our legislator about it. Apparently, auto insurers have much more disclosure requirements than homeowner insurance. And I finally did find the clause about cancellation on page 16 of 28 of our policy. So it is actually in the policy, but it isn't. You're not notified when you try to get insurance. So I believe that Chuck Wigger's amendment or bill would be very helpful, because a lot of times you're either dealing with somebody over the phone, you may be dealing with somebody on the web, but we do believe that it's important at the time of the application that people be notified that the policy could be canceled during the first 60 days, because that would at least give them an opportunity to ask why that might occur.
Mr. Wall, I'm wondering, when you say the notice to you on page 16 or whatever it is of the policy, that just says they could deny or retract coverage, but was there ever anything said where they would have the right to inspect the property or anything? I mean, one kind of presumes that if they're going to insure something, they'd want to come see it. I've had that experience.
I suppose that does make some sense. I think that we felt we were a little blindsided because basically we'd had the policy in effect for quite some time. The roof was newer, and our own personal inspection bore that out. So while I certainly understand the need for the insurers to protect themselves, the consumer is essentially just shopping around for a lower rate, and they're encouraged to do so by the competition within the industry.
Sure. Now, I mean, you could be in a real difficult place if the net, if you even tried to go back to your original insurer, and they might see the roof and deny you the same thing, and there you are caught in the middle, I understand.
That's right.
Do members have any questions? Senator Bretner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I clearly understand this. You're saying that any insurance company has the right to cancel a policy on the person they've insured within 60 days, and this is allowed? I mean, that's appalling to me. That's even allowed. I thought they entered into a contract with the person they were insuring, so...
Maybe Mr. Johnson from the Insurance Federation could speak to that, if he would. I don't want to put you on the spot. But.
Just did. She just did.
Mr. Johnson, welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Can I make just a couple of comments, and I'll answer the question, I think. And I was planning to just briefly indicate, we don't object as an industry to the disclosure. This Senate File 404 copies a 22-year-old law that's been on the books for auto insurance. In fact, it's verbatim. But it's one of the numerous laws, frankly, that we need to modernize, because commerce back then wasn't done on the Internet. And so insurance today, increasingly more and more and more consumers want to do business. They don't want paper. They want to buy on the Internet. And so from our industry's perspective, and I've had a chance to just briefly chat with Senator Wigger and Mr. Wall, that we would, in addition to the wording that's in the bill, think it'd be appropriate to add some language to acknowledge the disclosure on the insurer's website. Because, again, for those individuals, which is a growing number, they don't do paper. They don't want paper. And so the electronic communication in this instance, we think, makes sense. It's not contrary to this. It just acknowledges that as a method of doing business. And again, there are a number of laws that were drafted before consumers bought insurance on the Internet. I think as to the question, the answer is that insurers have the right and have had forever to underwrite. In other words, the ability to inspect the risk. And so state law in this area, Minnesota Statute 65A.29, that's the cancellation law for homeowners insurance, and state law limits the grounds that homeowners insurers can cancel, and one of the grounds is you get to underwrite the policy in that first 60 days. So that's the law in Minnesota. It's been the law for many years. It's the law in every state that you have to be able to validate, verify, inspect, if you want, the property before you insure it.
Senator Bretner-Solin.
Madam Chair and Mr. Johnson, don't they have to inspect it before they issue the insurance? And does this also mean then, is this just when a party changes insurance, or every year do they have that first 60 days in which to...
No. Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
No, it's the difference there is that in the initial underwriting for a new application, then you'd have the underwriting. There's a different state law that governs. It's called renewal. So homeowners' policies are 12 months. If you stay with the same company, they do not do that underwriting process again. So that 60 days would not apply to consumers that stay with the same company. So, again, there's separate statutes that limit the grounds that an insurer can non-renew a policy, and that would happen at the end of the 12 months. So this is for the initial issuance of a policy. So either, you know, if your people buy homes or whatever, or if they want to shop and move to a new insurer, then the new insurer has that statutory right to underwrite for that 60-day period.
Senator Wicker, Senator Prentice-Solon, were you done?
Well, Madam Chair, yes. And there's no requirement that the not investigation or the
inspection
of the property has to occur prior to the insurance then.
No, Madam Chair, no, there's not. And I think the practical reality is that, again, it's put in the cancellation law because for many consumers, they're buying a home and they call an agent and they want coverage. They'll issue coverage, so they'll have coverage, and then that underwriting period, they have to give notice, so there's still coverage during that period of time that they're walking through that. So it's protection for the consumer, but it preserves the ability to make sure that the property is what you're representing it is.
Senator Prentice-Solon.
So one more question then, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, what happens if there's an incident, an insurable incident during those 60 days?
No.
Mr. Johnson, is the party not covered?
No. Madam Chair, there's no gaps. In other words, they issue a binder, there is coverage, and that's why the law requires if they make the decision, they have to send notice, give them the reason, you know, what they flagged, so that state statute that this subdivision is put in delineates the process that a homeowner insurer has to follow.
Okay. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, how long, once you provide the notice that you're canceling, how long is it before the policy is actually gone?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, maybe the council can, off the top, I don't have the rest of that 65B29. The cancellation statute specifies the amount of days notice you have to give.
20.
I think it's 20 days.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty's 20 days.
So Senator Marty, the state law delineates the time frame of what insurers have to follow to effectuate a cancellation.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, then, again, in Mr. Wall's case where he had insurance and he was shopping around for a new policy, is there any way that a homeowner in that case, with or without this notice, could... say, look, I'd like you to do the underwriting ahead of time and so on because, you know, he's got something okay and he's shopping to get something better. And even if there was this notice there, the idea that he might 2 months later be without any coverage.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I, at least from what I've heard, and I haven't seen it all, but from what I've heard, my reaction is that I think the agent could have and should have done a better job of advising the customer about this process, because agents know that this underwriting period of time, and if I were the agent, I would have advised we can shop, but we're not going to drop the coverage that we have. We're going to keep that while we're doing the shopping. So I believe there's a way with, you know, direction from an agent, and in many cases it's done with agents, not always. And I think that gives some flexibility and ability to do the kind of shopping that you're asking about.
Senator Marty.
So, Madam Chair, so in effect, would under that scenario, would they be double insured for that time, or would the agent be saying, look, we'll get you approval to start the policy, but we won't actually cover you for 60 days so we can find out? Because otherwise he's got to pay, for 2 months he's got to pay double.
Right. Madam Chair, I think that the latter that you described, that there is a way for the agent to work with them to try to do that shopping and avoid that process.
Yeah, and that's, I think it's probably tough to legislate that. It's common sense, I suppose, if you know it, if you know the ground rule. If you don't know the ground rule, it doesn't matter how much common sense you have. And, Mr. Johnson, I think you make a really good point about the online piece and websites having that, but I asked Mr. Stang, and he said we don't have anything in requirement on auto insurance for websites. There might be other kinds of notices or other kinds of information that's given to consumers in writing that maybe should be on a website. That's something maybe that we should explore. I don't know, Senator Wieger, if you wanted to take that on in this or not. But it just strikes me that there could be other kinds of notifications.
Madam Chair, I don't want to clutter or weigh down Senator Wieger's bill, but it is based on a 22-year-old law which preceded how commerce is done today. Consumers increasingly do not want paper.
No,
so,
and
so
Mr.
we're
Johnson.
Working with them, and frankly, that no-fault law should be amended here or someplace to acknowledge electronic commerce and the reality. And many insurers, they want the consumers to drive to the website. If you go to insurers' website, there's a lot of good information there. It's a more effective mechanism to communicate
sure.
this. I think if you look at the wording of the bill, and I'm not here to quarrel with it, but even the wording of this, putting this in piece of paper in the hands of a consumer, if I received a piece of paper that said the insurer may elect to cancel at any time in the first 60 days following issuance for any reason which is not specifically prohibited by statute, I'd ask, what does that say? Because I think the dilemma from a consumer that they don't know what state statute specifies or not. So I'm not against the disclosure. I'm not arguing with the core purpose of Senate File 404, which is to put the consumer on attention or alert. But I'm not even sure copying the no-fault statute actually kind of advances the issue of getting to the consumer the information that you want them to have at that time they're doing this. To avoid taking a step that's that you want to avoid. So I'm not here with an amendments to change that. It is patterned after this 22-year-old law.
Okay.
But I think we can do better with the disclosures, both in the no-fault law and then what's in this bill.
So, pleasure. I think maybe that I sense maybe the author's not looking too excited about doing that in this bill. I think, though, Senator Wieger, it's something to think about, but I think we need to think about it in the larger context of all kinds of insurance, products and that sort of thing. Maybe we need to deal with things that should be on websites. I mean, I think we do need to do that. I agree with you, Mr. Johnson, that more and more people are not – well, first of all, very few people actually ever read what they get anyway, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Wieger.
Clearly, e-commerce evolution has many policy implications, and I agree with transparency on that website so that Mr. Wall and other consumers are duly protected. We're not at that point yet where we're going to do that on the website in lieu of written requirements right now. And I think you raise an important issue, as Mr. Johnson does, for the future and would address it. But I'd like to keep this bill as straightforward as we can to make it consistent with auto policies. And that would be my position.
Mr. Johnson,
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, and Mr. Wall, yes.
Yes, Madam Chair, I wonder if I could add something. It's the application that's important. And if you're talking to an insurer on the phone and they tell you that we may have the option to cancel coverage at any time during the 60 days. Oh, I see. Oh, under what circumstances might you do that? And if we had gotten the information that we are likely to come out and do an inspection and you could be denied coverage, we would very likely have continued our existing coverage during that 60-day period. So I think the notification is extremely important, even if it's done verbally.
Mr. Wall, and thank you. That clarifies it. And Senator Metzen would
I'll move the bill as amended.
Senator Metzen moves that Senate File Number 404 as amended be recommended to pass, and this will go right to the floor. And probably consent.
Sure.
Why not?
Go ahead.
I think it's probably consent calendar. material. Senator Wieger, is that strike other members that way? Senator Metzen, okay?
I think that's all right, yeah.
Sure. Any discussion? Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to say anything about this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Thank you.
Senator Lynch, do I have you next? I do. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here today with Senate File 688. We've had much discussion in this body over the last number of years on health care reform, particularly in areas of cost containment and evidence-based care. And I am pleased to bring you an initiative today that was recently as December of 2008, written up and discussed in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And without any further ado, Madam Chair, I have two testifiers with me today, Tom Spencer and Kathy King, who will walk you through the bill and give you the further details behind this initiative. And at this time, I would like to yield to Tom Spencer.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. Mr. Spencer, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I have a handout for each of the committee members, and we'll refer to the handout during the presentation.
Okay, we'll get it. It'll be passed out.
I've got one. Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Tom Spencer, and I am president of Advanced Healing Systems, a Minnesota employer. Advanced Healing Systems was founded in 2005 to become a leader in wound healing technology, information, and clinical outcomes. Our mission is to equip medical providers with the tools and the training to help their wound patients heal completely in the shortest time interval at the lowest overall cost to the payer and to society. Today, our company has 30 Minnesota nursing home customers, both rural and urban, including the three largest nursing homes in the state. We have 23 nursing home customers in seven other states. We have completed a web-based electronic medical record for wound care that is increasingly predictive of both time and cost to heal. Our HIPAA-compliant database, as of today, contains 1,602 patients, with 942 of these reporting complete healing in the last 3 months. 660 patients continue to treat. Our company and our licensed providers in Minnesota and elsewhere are ready to guarantee insurance companies, Medicare and Medicaid, a 25% reduction in all wound-related costs, including those associated with limb amputation. Thank you for allowing us to testify today. Senate file, one more note, Madam Chair.
Yes,
Senate
Spencer.
File 688 is intended to deal with wound care in nursing homes and in the community and to improve all wound care outcomes and lower costs.
And so, Senator Lynch, the bill, I maybe you just want to tell us precisely what it does. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, I think, but I want to be sure I understand where it goes. Is it
the bill, Madam Chair?
Mr. Spencer.
Reflects the formulary that is being provided from Hibbing to Winona, from Morris to White Bear Lake, in Des Moines, in Fargo, and in Owensboro, Tennessee today, in exactly the same way, to resolve all wounds regardless of their etiology in half the time, in half the cost, or less.
Okay, Mr. Spencer, but the actual bill says that health plans would cover,
correct,
100% of the cost, right? That's where we are. I don't know, maybe Senator Lynch, maybe you said that in the very beginning, but is it for a particular treatment? That's what I'm looking for, to try to understand if it's just one.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Spencer?
Our formulary contains all of the technologies that we use systematically in the provision of these services. It also includes provider training, an electronic medical record, and a wound guideline for practitioners who are licensed by the state and the health plans.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, and if I may, this is a mechanism that is currently not covered and reimbursed. And what we are seeking is that coverage and that reimbursement.
So, Senator Lynch, forgive me, but currently wound care is covered, but only certain types of wound care. And this one hasn't been adopted in the formulary, if that's what it would be, of the plans.
Okay. Madam Chair, that's correct.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, or Mr. Spencer, perhaps. So you're president of Advanced Healing Systems, and that is this type of wound care, is that correct, that you produce? Or
Senator, yes.
Okay, and why is that not covered?
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair. Like all innovation, it's at first opposed. And because it's not understood, there are no mechanisms in the usual and customary training protocols for providers, and it has to be introduced over time.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Spencer, how long has it been around? Has it been FDA approved?
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair, Senator, all of our tools are FDA approved.
And how long has it been around?
Mr. Spencer.
Since 2005 in Minnesota, perhaps the technology that we have heard in the past gives pause has been approved by CMS since 2004 and by the FDA since 1997.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
You mentioned that a guarantee that the providers or the state would save 25% or something like that if they use this system, and that you guaranteed it. How would you guarantee that?
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair, Senator, we license our providers, both in the nursing home and in the community primary care settings, to use our system of formulary-based care. It is through our providers who are licensed to use these protocols in the usual and customary course of treating wound patients that we would guarantee a 25% reduction in all costs related to wound care.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I guess I have lots of questions. I don't think I understand what your process is. Are you suggesting that you have your own staff to do the wound care? And that you bring those staff into facilities, or
Mr. Spencer?
We license staff in skilled nursing facilities and in primary care settings around the state, Madam Senator.
To Mr. Spencer, to use the, I don't know if it's a, if there's a device involved. Is it the electromagnetic?
That is one of our tools, okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, if I may, this technology is being used in a formulary protocol in 30 Minnesota nursing homes currently, and 23 nursing homes in 7 other states. And my other testifier today, Kathy King, is one of those providers, and it might be helpful for the committee to hear from her.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Before we go any further, Mr. Spencer, I'm still not clear about the 25% savings. So are you saying that you will pay these systems if they don't obtain a 25% savings, that you will guarantee that?
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair, Senator, excellent question, Senator. No, they simply would not pay us. So if we achieve a 25% savings or more as licensed providers in the state of Minnesota, licensed by the medical board and by the nursing board, they would not be paid for the care that they provide for these wound patients.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Prettner-Solon,
how do you identify if they've reached that 25% savings?
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair, Senator, we have an electronic medical record which is connected to a database which measures all care delivered in wounds, regardless of etiology, by cost. So all of the drugs, for example, topical antibiotics, systemic antibiotics, durable medical equipment, wheelchairs, and so on, are all measured within this formulary software, which is an electronic medical record. This is exactly what the President and the new administration are looking for. We have an operating system today in wound care.
Boy, I'm still confused, and I work in the healthcare industry.
Senator Lynch, perhaps we should have Ms. King speak to us.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Good afternoon. Thank you. I am the newest provider of this technology in the state of Minnesota, and I'm the director of nursing at Southview Acres Healthcare Center, located in West St. Paul.
And I just need you to give your name.
And I'm Kathy King. And actually, I started with implementing this technology in my facility approximately 6 weeks ago. And to this point in time, my staff, when you asked the question about if he brought people into the facility, no, that is not how it works. How it works is that the advanced healing people provide you with the technology, and they come in and train you into how to implement the data into the medical record. They provide someone to do wound rounds with you for about 4 weeks. But what it does in the facility is that the facility staff do wound rounds and do measurements and evaluate the treatments weekly and make recommendations, work with the medical teams, the nurse practitioners, and the physicians, and you keep inputting the data until the wounds are healed. To this point, I've healed 22 wounds in 4 weeks. And I have been in this industry for 30-plus years myself, and I've used everything from maggots to Maalox to heat lamps to dressings to everything you can imagine for wound healing. This is the best I've ever seen.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And could you give us an idea why you think that this is better?
Certainly.
Ms. King.
So there are three technologies that we utilize through advanced healing. The first one is a device that's called pulsed electromagnetic field therapy, which is basically it's a machine that you utilize for two treatments, 30 minutes a day. The second is we use a form of silver, which is different than the silver that is traditionally used in current dressings. The difference is that it has two ions of silver rather than one ion of silver, so that you don't have it keeps replenishing itself, and it's been developed by a company that in Iraq and in Afghanistan, so that it's been used on the front line in the wars, and it kills everything. It kills MRSA, it kills staph, it kills all the bugs. You spray that on the wound, and you dress it with whatever your dressing is. You utilize the pulsed electromagnetic frequency therapy twice a day. And by doing that, our wounds have healed faster than I've ever seen. So,
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The use of silver over a 2 or 3 week period of time could have some adverse effects.
Not with this. That's
Ms.
the difference.
King.
Excuse me. Yeah. Thank you, Senator. Not with this. This has the two ions. That's the important piece. The one with the one ion is the one where, if you saw the blue man on Oprah, where you can build up this one doesn't do that. You can't get toxic from the two-ion silver therapy.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that FDA approved?
Senator, yes, it is.
Brand new. So. I haven't heard of it.
So, Senator Lynch, have you had conversations with plans I don't know if anybody is covering this, and it seems to me, I see it looks like the the efficacy is on its side. I mean, it looks like it's working. And is it because it's new, you think, that so new that the field, the plans just aren't aware of, you know, how effective it is? Because if it works as it says, obviously it should save money. It saved time and a lot of pain, I'm thinking.
Madam Chair, I do believe that this is a relatively new technology. And frankly, I think I first stumbled upon this during a conversation that took place in one of the work groups for the Healthcare Access Commission in the, I think that was largely done in the summer of 2007 and in that fall. And frankly, one of the things that drew me closer to this were the incredible stories that I heard, like Ms. King has pointed out. She's had this in her facility for a relatively short period of time. And there were examples where, frankly, families were left with little hope. And sometimes the net result would result in amputation in some of the more catastrophic cases. And this technology has turned an awful lot of lives around for people. And beyond that, you know, I do think that a strong focus in our health reform discussions in this state have been about utilizing what we know to be best practice and making sure that we're getting the best return on our investments. And I believe that this technology fits that bill, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be to Council, but do we typically require 100% payment of a billed charge?
Mr. Stain.
As in line
with Madam Chair, Senator Scogin, I'm not sure I've ever seen it put quite that way.
Yeah, I don't think that's listed with when we have our mandated coverages, which are numerous.
For example, reasonable or something, common modifier.
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair, we're happy to negotiate with the plans because our interest, of course, is superior health outcomes and lower costs. So we're happy to do that. I would also mention that PEMF, pulsed electromagnetic field therapy, has been talked about, and I would refer everyone to Exhibit A. This is a first for us. Frankly, we're very pleased about it, and I wanted to share it with the committee members this afternoon. In the December Journal of the American Medical Association, for the first time, PEMF was incorporated in a meta-analysis. It was not only judged superior to the other therapies that are being used, but the null hypothesis was 99%. Now, I just make one point about the vacuum therapy, because the state spends an awful lot of money, multiple millions on vacuum therapy. And most of our nursing home licensees do not allow vacuum therapy into the buildings. It's too expensive and it's equivocal. In fact, JAMA came out and gave it a no recommendation. If I may refer to the rest of the packet, I'd just like to take you briefly through it and refer to Ms. King for one of the cases for her testimony. In Exhibit B, this is a wonderful outcome, and it's done by providers who are licensed by us in Brainerd, Minnesota. And I just refer you to the pictures so that everyone, including the interested parties in the room, can see. So far, this nursing facility has saved a life, they've saved the limb, and now they will report full thickness healing in the next update of the database. So this is a wonderful outcome, and they treated it all without surgical intervention and without more systemic antibiotics. Exhibit C is a case in Fargo, North Dakota, and it's a very common case, decubitus ulcers. And in a CMS report in 2006, CMS suggested that Minnesota's share of decubitus ulcer costs on an annualized basis tops $200 million. We know we can cut that cost by a minimum of 25% at a time when the hospitals no longer receive reimbursement for decubitus ulcer care. Finally, I would like to refer to Ms. King on Exhibit D because this is her patient, and perhaps you would like to talk about that.
Sure. Ms. King.
Madam Chair, this woman actually came from Hennepin County Medical Center. She was an 87-year-old woman living in assisted living, had company, was making a pot roast, went to get the pot roast out of the oven, backed up, tripped. The whole pot roast fell on her in her legs. And Hennepin County pretty much gave up on her and sent her to us. And we, within 67 days, we had her back home, healed, totally with. And that was after some discussions with the wound clinics about, can we use the therapy, can we not use the therapy? And finally, when we got the okay from the wound clinic and implemented our therapy, we were able to get her healed and get her back home and where she is today.
Pretty amazing stuff.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Spencer.
I would just like to refer everyone to Exhibit F in case they've never seen the picture of a formulary before. This looks very much like our doctors and nurses provide care every day. It's a six-step process, with the sixth step meaning we either release the patient because he or she has healed completely, or we continue the care on a prescription. May I point out that this is a SNP plan member, a dual eligible member in the state from Brooklyn Park, who was threatened with the amputation of her foot after 6 months of care in the hospital, in the nursing home, and in the wound clinic. 47 days later, in 2006, she was healed completely, and Medica gave us a temporary provider number and paid us faster than even our nursing home customers do. We did guarantee this therapy. We said to Medica, if we can't heal it, don't pay us. We're happy to take that guarantee to the rest of the providers and the payers.
Mr. Spencer, I assume you've marketed this, you've talked to the plans. When I say marketed, I don't mean in a commercial sense, but you've explained the process and their medical team.
The plans are very busy people, as we know, and we have tried to discuss this protocol with them. On May 14th of last year, we assembled in Linda Berglund's office, Senator Berglund, and she said, this is innovation like we've never seen before, and the plans know what to do. I want to report back that, in fact, we've been able to negotiate in good faith. And so far, we haven't been able to get back with that report. I think that's the reason we're here today, Senator.
Okay. That's helpful to know. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds to me like they are making headway, though. It sounds like they're forging their own path in this new innovation. And Mr. Spencer, is there a way, when you say you're willing to negotiate, but is there a way to cut your own costs, for instance, the database? I'm not quite clear why that's important. Obviously, you have people like Ms. King in the field that can quantify the results in her charting. What's the database for?
Well,
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair, Senator, the database actually stores all of the treatments, so please understand that in an electronic medical record, we require of our licensed providers that they keep every patient, of course, in a HIPAA-compliant mode in the database so that they can now show the surveyors who come from the state their result. This eliminates a lot of the litigation and a lot of the issues that go on with checking on the progression of wounds. Please understand that with these technologies combined, we have the general as well as specific expectation that we will see resolution of wounds to full thickness healing. I am happy to report as well to the committee that our database so far shows 95% full thickness healing in all wound etiologies, including burn care, and 99% clinical effectiveness in terms of moving the wound towards full closure and keeping them infection-free. This is a remarkable thing. And we're so happy and privileged to be working with the Minnesota providers because they, without their support and their belief in the best practices, now with evidence-based clinical practice, this would not be possible. This is going to revolutionize wound care. I would also point out that we've been contacted in the last 3 months by providers in Saudi Arabia and in Ireland.
Okay. So, Ms. King, and then I'm going to ask people who have asked to speak.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would like to say that as one of the last family-owned businesses in the state as far as long-term care is concerned, we felt we had no choice but to do this. This is much more cost-effective for us, even right now, paying for it ourselves, rather than sending somebody to a wound clinic and spending $2,000 in treatment or transportation that I have to pay for. For me to have this in my facility, for my own staff to be able to case manage it and to see healing twice as fast, it costs, I mean, a family business, and we know that we're going to get more cuts from the state. We are on a very thin line as far as reimbursement. And so even without the health plans reimbursing us at this time, this is much more cost effective for me.
Senator Lynch, and I'm going to ask, there are some people that have asked to testify in opposition. Mr. Bartsch is one of them. Actually, he's the only person I have listed, but I don't know.
You have the seat here. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bartsch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bartsch. I represent Health Partners. I'm also here today representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is made up of Minnesota's 8 nonprofit health plans. We do oppose Senate File 688, a bill to require coverage for formula-based wound care. We oppose the bill on a number of fronts, the largest being that there is no clear evidence to suggest the requirement of coverage for this treatment. A couple other questions. The bill itself is unclear to what formulary-based wound care is. I think that was some of the discussion earlier. We understand what the components of that might be, but there is no definition in statute of what formulary-based wound care is. As mentioned earlier, the bill requires reimbursement at 100% of billed charges, making this, at least to my knowledge, the only treatment whereby there's no negotiation over the price. And the bill does provide a money-back guarantee. I'll talk about that later, but let's just say that's a unique statutory tool, and it raises some issues in regard to the concept of do no harm. But I want to focus on the issue of evidence when it comes to requiring or coverage new treatments. The proponents of this new technology certainly believe in its benefits and that they believe it can provide a better approach to care. And you can tell they believe in that. They're passionate about it. They think this works. They want everyone to know that this works. And their presentation and some of their examples are impressive, but they do not create a level of evidence by which treatment should be considered effective, by which health plans should be covering it, and clearly there's no evidence by which state law should be changed to mandate coverage of this treatment. Health plans use technology review processes in determining if and how to cover new technologies, and these reviews look at research and clinical trials to make determinations. Multiple research, multiple clinical trials to make a cost-effective analysis, making sure that new treatment and new technologies are more effective than their predecessors. There's no evidence to support that with this new treatment. If there is, we haven't seen it, and the JAMA article was referenced, the JAMA article from December 2008. Let me read to you the conclusion of that article, and if I have a different one, please correct me. Here's the conclusion. Little evidence supports the use of a specific support surface and dressing over other alternatives. Similarly, there is little evidence to support routine nutritional supplement or adjunctive therapies compared with standard care. JAMA looks at a number of different research, a number of different clinical trials versus placebo and versus what they know. And what they've said when they look at multiple trials is there's no evidence to support this is a better treatment than standard of care. Now, there may be a time in the future where enough research has gone into this where that determination can be changed, but it hasn't happened yet. I also want to state CMS, it was recognized, does cover this treatment as of 2004. Again, if the situation has changed since then, please let me know. But CMS does not cover electromagnetic therapy as an initial modality for the treatment of wounds. This is not being covered. There is no clear evidence to suggest that this is a standard of care more effective than other treatments. And again, clearly there's no evidence out there to suggest that this is of such a high priority that state law needs to be changed to require its coverage. What this bill does do is go around the process that, Madam Chair, you asked about, and that is working with individual payers to assess a new technology, to determine its effectiveness, and to achieve coverage. This goes around that, and that's a dangerous precedent. What you are doing is you are inviting the makers of any new device or drug to forego that process and come to the legislature and ask you to be the new Medical Technology Review Committee for the state of Minnesota. And I don't think that's an appropriate place to be making these decisions. Again, the language in the bill is unclear about what formula-based wound care actually means. And on the issue of the guarantee of cost, this is interesting. I do believe it speaks, again, to the proponent's belief in what they are selling. But I don't think that's an appropriate thing to be putting in statute. And while the money-back guarantee talks about a guarantee on the dollars, I don't think it takes into account the guarantee on patient safety or what this would mean for patients. The money-back guarantee references dollars, but it doesn't take into account the fact that patients will undergo this treatment more effective or less effective, and that's something we need to remember. Madam Chair, for all of these reasons and numerous others, we oppose this legislation. Again, it's clear to me that the makers of this new device believe in it, but there are protocols by which they can go and seek coverage for it. They have not undergone that in this instance. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Bartsch, I wondered, what would be the process if it's not, I don't want it to be, you know, I don't want proprietary information, but what would generally be the process for an insurer or an HMO to approve a new technology? I don't know what the latest one is that's been approved. You know, I mean, heaven knows these things come fast and furiously when they come, and we're learning things with wound care in Iraq, for example, that we didn't know 10 years ago. And we know we can keep people alive longer, and we can do all kinds of things. It looks like they're healing wounds in a way. I can't speak to the cost effectiveness because I don't know what the cost is, okay? But if it's more effective, arguably over the long run, it would be less expensive. I'm looking at, honestly, I don't know if plans cover any of these other therapies, but one actually had a better result with the placebo and ultrasound than it did with just the ultrasound, which, okay, well, there's, I guess we, you know, placebos was doing what it was supposed to do, I guess. But can you tell me what would be the policy if somebody, Mr. Spencer, comes with this product and, or, the, you know, this medication, this drug, this process, whatever it is, and says, you know, would you look at this? What do you do?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I only speak for Health Partners, but I'm assuming the process is similar for other health plans. Each of us has a technology review council within our plan. And when new treatments, new technologies, new drugs are brought to the market and they are requested for coverage, we will do a review of the literature and the evidence behind those treatments. In this instance, that literature and that evidence does not even exist to make a qualified determination. So in essence, what we will do is we will look at the literature and the evidence, the clinical trials that have been done with these new procedures to see if they qualify for coverage. Has not happened in this instance.
Mr. Bartsch, would you ever just look at where it's being used? And you know, I don't mean just taking, you know, this pamphlet on its face, but would you look at a nursing home where there have been multiple cases and you look at results versus results doing another treatment in another nursing home?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's part of a research analysis, is looking at results one case study versus another case study. But research and case studies are different things. Looking at a couple examples of how a treatment works is not considered, quote unquote, effective and provable evidence of effectiveness. They're case studies. It's not an instance where randomized clinical trials has proven effectiveness above and beyond something else. What we're talking about here is looking at some case studies and saying to ourselves, well, that looks to make sense, versus actually doing the research to determine if there is a more effective way to do these procedures.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Birch, then as long as they just move forward with treatment, you will never see the research that you're looking for.
Mr. Birch.
Madam Chair and Senator Scogin, no. I'm assuming they will continue to pursue, as they have, trying to place their research and evidence like in journals like JAMA or other institutions, or continue to gather their own evidence so that they can come back and show that they are more effective. What we're saying is that hasn't happened yet.
Senator Sparks.
Madam Chair, and kind of to that same line then, Mr. Barch, do the health plans know what their wound care costs are currently?
Mr. Barch.
Madam Chair and Senator Sparks, I don't know that off the top of my head. I can certainly get it for you. And again, if this proves to be a more effective and more cost-effective treatment, we certainly will consider it for coverage. What we're stating today is that that hasn't been shown yet, and it's not ready to be requiring coverage in state law of something where we don't believe the evidence is there to show a greater effectiveness than other treatments.
Senator Prettner-Solon, and then Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this really to Mr. Spencer. This is interesting to me, and you suggest some remarkable results. And my daughter happens to run a wound clinic associated, an outpatient wound clinic associated with the burn unit. And I've never heard anything like this. So I intend to bring her this packet of information and show it to her. I'm wondering if you could tell me how much your treatments cost.
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you for the question. On Exhibit E, we provided a comparative technology cost by treatment.
But how many treatments, Madam Chair, Mr. Spencer, how many treatments do you require compared to the other types of treatments?
Mr. Spencer.
Madam Chair, Senator, approximately half or less in virtually every case in terms of days, if you think of treatment days. So that would be the quick comparison. But clearly, the cost driver in the formulary is the PEMF technology. And on a treatment basis, we would say, for example, compared to hyperbaric oxygen therapy at the hospital, you can see the difference in treatment cost. And people don't usually heal up at the hospital. They heal up in a step-down facility or at home. So wound care costs continue, as you know, and as your daughter would certainly know, for a long period of time, especially if they don't heal, which is part of the problem. If I may, Madam Chair, I would just like to refute something that was said by Health Partners' representative. The PEMF therapy has actually been paid for in another sector of medicine for over 25 years in orthopedics. Now, it is true that this is an advanced form of that, but it's been on the books since, I believe, 1982. We have never been able to get, until now, randomized control studies accepted. But I can refer the committee to over 279 studies since 1979 relative to this therapy in dermal applications. Now, I would also point out that the JAMA article that was commented on replies in its conclusion to standard care, dressings, ointments, topicals. If the representative would like to look at the study, we can point out to where it is given a recommendation, and that's the recommendation we cited. So for the first time in the history of PEMF, the Journal of American Medical Association is recommending it for pressure ulcer care. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Did somebody, Senator Metzen, were you?
Yeah, just You know, God forbid that somebody comes in with an innovative idea that might save us some money. You know, and we've heard discussion about nursing homes, positive results. We've heard discussion about Iraq and the battlefields we're in today, where it works. And it just seems to me that Senator Lynch is coming in with the healthcare industry, when inflation is 15 to 18% or whatever it is, around that number, and all other inflation is about 2 or 3%. And this isn't a save-all, but it's a step in the right direction to contain health care costs. And why do we fight this kind of stuff? I don't understand it. So that's more of a comment than anything, but I think Senator Lynch should be congratulated for bringing at least a small step forward in the health care delivery industry. And when's it all going to end? I don't have the ideas, but people have to come forward with the suggestions that might save some money, and I guess I think that's probably a good idea.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, just Senator Metzen's comments. I agree with you. It's just that I don't feel like a case has been presented that this actually will save money. And I'm afraid that indeed what will happen is that it will add costs because it will be a mandate on the insurance companies, which will get passed on to the rest of us. I also am very concerned about 100% of bill charges, which seems pretty unusual to me. Usually that's a negotiated item. And I would certainly, I'm hoping it's successful, but I feel like we need more evidence before we would say that we would just mandate this for the state of Minnesota, because there are a lot of promising things out there right now. And I don't think that we can just go ahead and mandate them because they seem promising. I'd like to see more proof.
Well, Senator Prettner-Solon, to that point, I mean, Senator Lynch, I'm intrigued with this, and I'm very impressed. And I guess if you just were to ask my opinion, I'd say I think everybody ought to be doing this. But if we do a mandate, I think it's something like 27% of Minnesotans would be covered by the mandate. I think that's the number, that we're down to that in terms of fully insured, that we understand that we're not covering people in ERISA-type plans. Am I correct, Mr. Bartsch?
Madam Chair, I believe that's the correct number.
So that's a problem, just mandating it. It falls on, I think, a lot of people who are just have individual plans, that kind of person, and we don't really want to have a negative impact on the cost of them. But I'm really interested in pursuing, this. Probably like Senator Berglund, who probably has a little more clout in the area than I do. We're not exactly qualified on the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee. Well, I should only speak for myself. I'm not qualified to make medical or health care related, determinations like this. We kind of look at the principles of the insurance, and so we have to consider that 27% number, the ERISA plans, and then obviously the 100% billing. That I think there's some work to be done. Can you have some thoughts for us that might give us some direction? Well, let her answer that first, Senator Prettner-Solon. Okay.
Senator Scheid, thank you for your comments. To the committee, we have received invitation to go to Senator Marty's committee.
Yes.
If we are successful here today. So you can anticipate that there will be more of that health policy discussion that will take place there. But to this committee, I guess my plea to you today is just this. We spend an awful lot of time talking about the desire to have Minnesota lead. We spend an awful lot of time talking about healthcare reform. We spend an awful lot of time talking and acknowledging that we must both be talking about reform and cost containment ideas and making sure that we get the best return for our investment. And all of those things are challenging and difficult and will require change. And I heard the new administration comment that there's been a lot of talk but we can no longer afford to wait. And so what I'm asking you today is to help us continue in this direction, to help Minnesota lead. When I look at Exhibit E, as noted in the JAMA article, and I see there that we have the potential to bring forward some new technology that arguably, at this point, you know, we can argue to the degree to which it's more successful or not more successful, or how many studies have been or done or haven't been done. The fact of the matter is it costs less money. That's should be appealing to all of us. And we have some very significant evidence across the state of Minnesota, as noted in some other states. I think we need to have some courage, continue the discussion. I heard some of the concerns that were noted by the committee, particularly in the area of the definition, particularly in the area of the 100% reimbursement. I think that's duly noted. One of the notes that I took was with regard to the guarantee, and this might not be something that Mr. Spencer's all that excited to hear, but with regard to the guarantee, you know, perhaps that is something that shouldn't be legislated, and perhaps that is something that needs to more appropriately be negotiated. But I ask your indulgence.
Senator Lynch, I'm going to ask you if you can pare this down. I really would like to send it on to the Health Committee for the health care implications of it, but I'm not real fond of the shape it's in. And in terms of, you know, well, the 100% billing and also just the definition of formulary-based wound care, I don't know, maybe that has a definition someplace, but Mr. Stang and I don't know where it is, you know, what that is statutorily. And if we need to pare down some of these requirements about what's covered, I don't know. Yes, Senator Prettner-Solon?
Madam Chair, I think another issue is that it appears that this does not apply to the public programs. And if it is a cost savings, then why are our government programs not covered by this, also are mandated by this?
Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I'm with your line of thinking. I would like to see this move into the health, but before we do that, this committee should look at this unusual broad language and get it more to what we're used to.
Yeah, we're kind of used to the 3- and 4-word mandates, Senator Lynch. Which does not make anybody happy in this room. But, we don't feel technically competent to do that.
Madam Chair, if I may summarize. Senator Prettner-Solon, very good point with regard to the public programs. I think that's an excellent suggestion. I think that's one that could be incorporated. I think... we heard your comments with regard to definition. We heard your comments with regard to the 100% reimbursement. We heard your comments with regard to the guarantee. Those are all items, those are four areas that I've noted. And I guess my commitment to you is that I've heard your requests, I've heard your suggestions, and would be committed to amending the language.
Senator Lynch, I'm going to ask that you do that in this committee.
Okay.
I think my sense from the committee is we'd like to feel better about it if it leaves here. Okay. So I'm going to lay it over. I think, I don't know, we lay on the table, we lay it over and ask you to do that, and we will come back as soon. I know it has to go to Senator Marty's committee if we pass it, but would you work on that, on the definition thing? I mean, we can
quickly take out and reimburse it 100% of billed charges. That would be easily done. But I don't think we know where to go with that formulary-based wound care phrase. And so, and I'd like to see something also about public. I mean, that's necessarily for our committee, but I'm real interested in seeing you go someplace with that. And Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that. I would respectfully request an invitation to return.
Oh, Senator Lynch, you do have that, you know, before the deadline, before you'd need to get to another committee, if you can shape this up a bit.
Absolutely.
And very interesting testimony. And I'd encourage continued conversation with plans and just maybe get some kind of direction there as to what. And Mr. Spencer, I suspect, I don't know how long you've been in this business, but that you know that you have to show some evidence-based research to them. And so, okay. Members, I appreciate everybody's attention. It's a very interesting subject. Senator Lynch, thank you. We're laying it over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you.
Mr. Spencer, thank you. Mr. Bartsch, thank you.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Senator Phoebe.
I know. Maybe we'll do that, though. Maybe we'll do that when we get to this.
Thank you.
We may just find it.
I want to. I want to be the trial case.
Senator Phoebe, welcome to our committee.
Thank you,
We're
Madam
a fun
Chair.
Group.
Yes. Switching gears here, I really want to thank you today, Madam Chair and members, for hearing this bill. I'm here today on behalf of Senate File 708. And with that lengthy discussion, just take a deep breath, and we're on to foreclosures.
Good advice, Senator Phoebe.
So, Madam Chair, I first would, before we even get started, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment so we can get it tucked away.
And Senator Sparks would offer the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like. Members?
It's coming right here.
Get that. Thank you. And that amendment just has an insertion on page 2, line 34, after organization.
Right. And as soon as everybody just is looking at it, it's an author's amendment. I just like to have everybody seeing it.
Yes.
Looks like it's narrowing a definition and... All those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Phoebe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I come to you today. I've worked on this with the Attorney General's office. This has to do with the area of foreclosures. I got involved and was anxious to get involved because I represent an area of the state that has some of the highest foreclosures per capita in the state, Mille Lacs County and Sherburne County. So as you probably recall, some of you, in 2004, the legislature passed a law barring foreclosure consultants from charging any compensation until after the foreclosure consultant had fully performed each and every service that they were contracted to perform. What has happened now is, unfortunately, with every law, people like to find those little loopholes, and there was a loophole found, and there's been a new breed of companies that's been operating like a foreclosure consultant, promising to negotiate or modify terms of homeowners' existing mortgages, but instead targets homeowners who may be struggling financially but are not yet in default on foreclosure. Additionally, some of these scam artists have labeled themselves or put themselves forward claiming that they're nonprofit organizations trying to get out of the law. So this proposed legislation is designed to close that loophole in the existing state law regulating foreclosure consultants and to prohibit so-called mortgage modification companies from soliciting any upfront fees and then failing to deliver the promised services. And with me today, I have Attorney General Assistant Carla Heil to go over the bill and explain it more. Ms. Heil, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carla Heil. And as Senator Phoebe said, foreclosure consultants typically represent that they can save a homeowner's home from foreclosure by negotiating or modifying the terms of the homeowner's existing mortgages. And what they have done is that these companies use websites, targeted mailings, and telephone solicitations directed at financially distressed homeowners. And as Senator Phoebe said, in 2004, the state legislature did prohibit foreclosure consultants from charging any fees up front before the services were fully performed. The Attorney General's office has sued 12 of these companies already, and we have gotten consent decrees with at least two of these companies where they can no longer practice in the state of Minnesota, and they must give restitution to the citizens where they took the money without performing the services. What this bill does, as Senator Phoebe has said, is there are four amendments necessary to tighten the law to prevent people that now go after people who are just financially distressed, not actually in foreclosure. And the first is to add the language that negotiating changes in an existing residential mortgage would come under the foreclosure consultant definition. The second change is that a licensed mortgage originator, even though they are exempt from a foreclosure consultant, they also cannot charge up front for services that they have not performed. Nonprofit agencies also remain exempt from a foreclosure consultant, but they also cannot get fees up front until they perform the service. And the final amendment is that the definition of service is broadened to include contacting creditors or mortgage services to negotiate or offer to negotiate changes to an existing mortgage loan. And we believe that these changes will tighten the law and clarify our public policy to prevent these type of people from preying on people that are financially distressed.
So, Ms. Heil, can I ask you, we don't have the full statute, at least each of our members doesn't, but this is really definitional change, and could you refresh our memory just one more time what we said about financial consultants, or excuse me, foreclosure consultants? There's other language that says what they must do, or I assume there's prohibited practices as well, or?
Correct. 325N, and it's basically from 0.01 to 0.12, the main gist of the provisions that the legislature enacted in 2004 is to prevent them from charging and collecting fees up front when they have not performed services. The second big part was that they must have contracts where the person gets to rescind the contract within 3 days, and there has to be notification of that.
Okay, so I know that you said that. I just wanted to, I was kind of looking for it in here, and then I realized we just have 0.01. We just have the definitional piece of the bill. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering if the person isn't yet in foreclosure, just out of curiosity, I guess, how are they being located? How do you find people who are in financial distress and target them?
Ms. Heil.
Madam Chair, I believe that one of the ways that they have done it, it is the website, and they might have looked for other services such that they now get phone solicitations, and there's also direct mailing. But I believe probably through the website initially might be one of the ways.
And I'm wondering, Ms. Heil, do they even necessarily call themselves foreclosure consultants anymore? Or is it?
Madam Chair, they do not, and that is part of the reason that we want to expand the language.
Members, any other questions?
Is that yours?
Senator Olson. Do we like this?
Senator Olson. then moves that Senate File 708 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there anybody in the audience that would has concerns about the bill or would like to speak about it? No? I'm seeing a collective shaking no of the heads. So, discussion members, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Phoebe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And you just go right to the floor, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Dahl, do you want to do your... Of course, I should wait till tonight so you'd have to stay, but...
No. Oh. You're not going to get home.
No wonder.
Would you hold for just a minute?
Yeah.
Help me out of it.
Whatever you need.
Staying about.
Right. Mr. Chair, fellow committee members, I have before you Senate File 743, and it's just a technical bill, just some technical changes that were brought to me. Obviously, stuff on here dealing with. The specifications and testing and materials, we're just moving some statutes into their proper places, and I think defining biodiesel blends and fuels. So that's all it is just a technical bill and something they do quite regularly. I'd ask for your support on this bill, and one here would like to speak.
Mr. Sexton, welcome to the committee.
Hi, Pat Sexton from the Department of Commerce. Yep, this is our annual weights and measures bill. Never gets a no vote, never has any controversy. Shouldn't probably say that, but just so you know, this is we just update our standards to make sure that our testing is accurate and conforms with national standards. Do have one amendment that I talked to Mr. Stang about that if we could do, I'd like to do. It's to delete two different sections. There's just some confusion with the ASTM standards that their engineers, our folks, suggested we should just get rid of to eliminate any confusion. It would be to remove section 6 and section 12.
Why don't we make it where it's automatic?
Mr. Chair, I'd move that amendment.
Okay. Senator Dahl moves that we delete section 6 and section 12 of the bill. Any further discussion?
No, Chair.
Senator Metzen.
We do this, I believe, every year. Why can't we... Is there a way to get some language in where Senator Dahl and others wouldn't have to come back every year and to make it automatic? Is that possible?
Mr. Sexton?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mensah, I hadn't thought of that before. We do...
That's where you got me.
We have talked to the revisor's office in other areas about how can we just simply have the agency or the commissioner update things that occur elsewhere in federal law, et cetera. Human Services does a lot of that. We can certainly take a look at it for this. I mean, these are very perfunctory changes every year.
Senator Scogin, did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to have Mr. Sexton, Mr. Chair, explain a little bit about 6 and 12 before we cut them out of there.
Okay. The issue is not... We're going to revert back to current law. The question is the ASTM – sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin. The issue is this standard, apparently the engineers at Weights and Measures and at the ASTM, there is some confusion about what this means and how it would be implemented. So instead of allowing for any confusion, we're going to get rid of 6 in Section 12. It'll cause no harm in the marketplace. I believe even Section 12 is a revenue – we're updating revenue statutes as well to make sure that the tax issues conform, their tax standards conform with ASTM standards. So there should be no confusion in the marketplace, no confusion from our end as well, or either.
Further discussion on the Dahl motion. Senator Scogin, did that help?
Yep.
That we delete Section 6 and Section 12. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Metzen.
It just seems to me this is a consent calendar material. I would suggest Senator Dahl moves it, adds that to his motion.
Any further discussion? Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Saxon, do you set the blending on biodiesel? I mean, the reason I ask that is because I've had some constituents wonder if we could go to a winter exemption and then a higher level in the summer to avoid some of the gelling and freeze up of the filters that we've had. And I'm just wondering if you're part of that, if I come through you to seek that out, or where do I... We think we could actually sell more biodiesel if we had a higher summer rating and then had a winter exemption to kind of protect the trucking industry a little bit.
Mr. Sexton?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, I don't pretend to understand the particulars of that, but absolutely, the Weights and Measures and the Energy Office in our department work very closely with the biodiesel statutes. The issue that occurred, the clogging of the buses a couple months ago, I think it was pretty clear that that was not... That had nothing to do with the statutes of the biodiesel or whatever. So,
I think we're talking about some low sulfur, Mr. Chair, some low sulfur fuel maybe there. However, when I'm only 90 miles from North Dakota, the trucks aren't stopping in my district anymore if they know they can make it out of Minnesota to fuel up, because they don't want to take the chance. So, food for thought on a winter exemption.
The bottom line is, Senator, we'd absolutely work with you on that.
Good point, Senator Scogin. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 743? If not, Senator Dahl.
I move Senate File 743 as amended and recommended to go to the consent calendar.
Further discussion on Senator Dahl's motion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
Chair and committee.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.
Committee members, the committee is going to recess now until 7 p.m. or after capital investment adjourns, whichever is sooner, and we'll take up Senate File 340, Senator Scheid's Homestead Lender Mediation Act. Committee's in recess.